It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's an all-American Thanksgiving from the man of the golden palate. Our food find expert, David Rosengarten, has left behind the truffles and caviar. We are feasting from his new book. It's All-American Food, the food we really eat. Well, the Sterns are in America's capital with the locals and politicos at the Florida Avenue Grill. Food forager Ari Weinschweig says there is life beyond balsamic. Men's Journal columnist John Hodgman tells us what every civilized carnivore should know. And then it's a story of a family in Bombay, a father's love in a cup of steamed milk. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Red ripe tomatoes, I'm never satisfied. I want the frim-fram sauce with the offs and fade, with shafafa on the side. I don't want pork chops and bacon that won't awaken my appetite inside. I want the frim-fram sauce with the offs and fade, with shafafa on the side. Well, you know a girl, she really got to eat, and a girl, she should eat right. Five will get you ten. I'm gonna feed myself right tonight. I don't want fish cakes and rye bread. You heard what I said, waiter, please. I want my fried, I want the frim-fram sauce with the awesome fay, with shafafa all on the side. Shoo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. Shoo-ba-doo-ya-doo-doo-doo-doo. My appetite inside. I want the frim-fram sauce.
the Alts and Faye with Shafafa on the side. Now you know, girls, we really got to eat, and you know we should eat right. Fire will get you ten. I'm gonna feed myself right tonight. I don't want fish cakes and rye bread. You heard what I said, waiter, please. I want my mind fried. I want the frim fram sauce with the Alts and Faye with Shafafa on the side.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today, David Rosengarten brings us a menu for an all-American turkey day, including his double whammy turkey. Talk about a new approach. And there are lots of other surprises. We get the skinny on vinegars beyond balsamic from food forager Ari Weinschweig. Men's Journal editor John Hodgman questions the cosmic truth of a real man knows how to carve. Indian Food Authority Raghavan Iyer tells of growing up in Bombay, his father's heart in a cup of steamed milk. And then we get into ye old holiday beverage, mead. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
You know, Lynn, you can eat the cuisines of the world in Washington, D.C., but there are very few restaurants that are unique to the capital. One of them, and one of the best restaurants on the East Coast in terms of urban eateries, is the Florida Avenue Grill. It's been an institution in Washington, D.C. since 1946.
It's a soul food restaurant, we should say, and probably has the best fried pork chops in the world, smothered or unsmothered. That the word smothered always kind of gives me the creeps, but I guess if you can, you know, decreep yourself, it's well worth it.
In fact, one of the things we love to do at the Florida Avenue Grill is eat breakfast, and those pork chops make a very suitable breakfast, especially if you get them with the Florida Avenue Grill stewed apples on the side. I mean, stewed apples are stewed to the point where they verge on applesauce. They're kind of spicy, sweet, caramelized, and with the pork chops and maybe with a couple of hot biscuits from the oven on the side, that is a royal breakfast.
Now, one thing that I didn't think I would like, but I really did like at the Florida Avenue Grill, was Michael and I stopped by for lunch about a year ago, and we asked the waitress what was the special for the day, and she said pig feets. And I don't know. Pig feets or pig's feet, it does not sound good to me, but they were so delicious. They came with kind of a breathless glaze of hot sauce on them and collard greens and these wonderful stewed apples, and kind of made me rethink my feeling about feets of pigs.
However, if you're squeamish about extremities of pigs, there are sort of some of the more common cuts of pig, in addition to pork chops, they have spare ribs that are really wonderful. You know, a lot of the time I feel that we become way too accustomed to those baby back ribs that are so common in restaurants. These are real spare ribs. They take a little bit of effort to pull the meat off the bone, but they reward you with such a depth of flavor that you never get in those baby back ribs.
You know what it is? It's the fat.
Yeah, of course. It's always the fat, isn't it?
Baby back ribs are too lean. But go on.
What we need to talk about regarding the Florida Avenue Grill is what kind of place it is, in addition to the great soul food they serve. It is a wonderfully democratic, small D kind of restaurant, because when you go in there, it is very likely that you will be sitting at the counter or in a sprung spring booth, side by side with cab drivers, blue-collar people, as well as senators, congressmen, and cabinet members. The walls of this place are covered top to bottom, end to end, with photographs of the famous and maybe not so famous people who love this restaurant because it is such a soulful taste of the capital.
And now that Scholl's Cafeteria, which was one of our favorite places in D.C., is no longer, Ben's Chili Bowl and the Florida Avenue Grill are kind of the must places to eat when we go to D.C.
Well, now we know where we're going to go to eat. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
The Stearns are authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, every week you hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're cruising the site, don't miss signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. And what a deal. Every week you get a new recipe for a fast supper dish. You get technique tips and shopping information. And best of all, it's free. But you can't get it unless you sign up. So get to that website, splendidtable.org. Ari Weinschweig sells food. He's one of the forces behind Zingerman's Deli and Mail Order in Ann Arbor. He is also one of the food world's outstanding foragers. Now, this means going behind the food, digging until you understand what makes quality. Now, he's put much of that information in his new book, Zingerman's Guide to Good Eating. Ari, good to have you back.
It's a pleasure to be back.
You know, I'd like to put aside balsamic vinegar for a moment and talk about great vinegars that are not balsamic. So what is high on your list?
There's all sorts of great ones. I mean, balsamic certainly, as you said, is well known and is very, very good. But I think it's unfortunately kind of overshadowed some of the really fantastic vinegars that are out there that people haven't had a chance to try or maybe have heard of but haven't tasted. Certainly sherry vinegar is one of my favorites, especially the time of year when the tomatoes are really nice because it's such a wonderful flavor combination. And there's some really great traditionally made sherry vinegars, some of them 25, 50 years old, that are just outstanding. And really, most of them are quite a good value for the money. One in particular is if you can find what's called a PX sherry vinegar. It's PX stands for Pedro Jimenez, and it's an old thing in the town of Jerez where the sherry vinegar is made in the southwest of Spain, that they would take a tiny bit of the Pedro Jimenez sherry itself and add that back to the vinegar in order to sort of round out the flavors, and it's really just a wonderful, wonderful product. And then there's a vinegar from the southwest of France that is not very well known, but really one of my longtime favorites. It comes from the town of Banyuls. Wine folks may know it because it's a very famous dessert wine from that area. But it's a vinegar somewhat in the same family as the sherry vinegar in that it's got a little bit of dryness, a little bit of sweetness. But it's a wonderful vinegar. It's made down in sort of big anchovy area down there near the Spanish border. And the vinegar is naturally converted. It's aged for about 5 years in oak barrels. And in total, the aging is almost 6 years, I think.
And what's
really
it called?
A fantastic vinegar. Banyuls. It's spelled B as in boy, A-N-Y-U-L-S. And it's really one of my regular salad dressing ingredients. It's really quite delicious.
What are we talking in both these vinegars as far as cost? What do they run?
Well, the last two that I've mentioned are sort of on the higher end. The Banyuls is about $23, $25, probably depending on where you buy it.
Uh-huh.
The PX vinegar, which is the very high end of sherry vinegars, would run about $40. Again, this that depends on the bottle size and where you're getting it, and of course there's different quality ranges and stuff as well.
Yeah, there's lower priced sherry vinegars that are pretty
good. Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can find anything from probably $3 or $4, which probably isn't what I would necessarily recommend. Into $10, $12, $15. Most of the sherry vinegars are quite nice value. The key to me is to find one that's naturally converted, because many of them no longer are. And then certainly the longer it's aged, the fuller the flavor, the more interesting the character of the mm-hmm. vinegar will be.
You know, I'd like to talk about the stepchild of vinegar, at least in the United States, cider vinegars.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about it. At one time in this country, that was, you know, the vinegar in New England, of course, because so many apples were being grown out in the fields and the orchards. And it's amazing how hard it is to find a really well-made cider vinegar in this country anymore. And we spent probably 2 years, 3 years looking, and finally found one that I've been really excited about that we're using quite a bit. Mm-hmm. It's made up in Quebec, and it's the gentleman's name is Gingras, is the last name, Pierre Gingras, and he grows all his own apples. They use only whole apples, so they're not using windfalls. They're not using scrapings or peelings that are left over from making cider. They're actually using whole apples for the vinegar. They do a natural conversion. The vinegars are aged in these huge oak barrels that were brought over for France. And I'm particularly partial. He does an organic vinegar that is aged for 2 years, and it really tastes like apples, and it's really wonderful. He also does another vinegar that's quite interesting based on the cider. This is one where he takes, at the end of the 2 years, they move it out of the oak and they put it into a series of different woods, not unlike you might do with balsamic, although it's a very different vinegar. And then they age it in these other woods. I know one of them is cherry wood. And so you get a much darker, more concentrated, sweeter vinegar. And it's, again, it's based on, it's a cider vinegar. So, I mean, it's still mm-hmm. apples, but mm-hmm. it's really quite delicious.
How do you like to use the cider vinegar?
Well, the regular apple cider vinegar I use quite a bit in vinaigrettes. I just did the other night just a simple salad with some toasted walnuts, some good Vermont cheddar, and just a tiny bit of applewood smoked bacon diced up and thrown in there, and some of the nice tomatoes and stuff that are around. And I make a vinaigrette with the cider vinegar and a little bit of olive oil.
That sounds good.
Very, very simple and very good. It's also really nice for deglazing the pan. If you've done a pork dish or some fish, you can put a little bit of the vinegar in, you know, get your spatula and deglaze the pan and pour that back quickly over your pork, and it makes a wonderful sauce. It's great for marinades, too. And then we're using it at the restaurant in our barbecue.
Great. Hey, Ari, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Ari Weintraub is author of Zingerman's Guide to Good Eating. You can find his picks of great vinegars on the website, splendidtable.org. Ari mentioned vinegars made by natural conversion. Well, let me explain what that means. Now, according to Ari, natural conversion is when wine turns to vinegar slowly and naturally. It's called the Orleans process. What happens is you partially fill wood barrels with wine, and the barrels have holes at the top, so a lot of air can get to the liquid. Natural bacteria from the air slowly converts the alcohol in the wine to water and acetic acid. And that's what we call vinegar. Now, this takes anywhere from 4 to 20 weeks. Most modern vinegar is made by inoculating wood shavings with bacteria and running wine over them at warm temperatures. In a week, you've got vinegar, but not vinegar with the same depth and character as the natural conversion. This is now something else for you to contemplate. Coming up, an All-American Thanksgiving with David Rosengarten, a lesson in manhood and carving, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/supertarget. Well, the Thanksgiving feast is a chronicle. As our lives change, our tables change. Each year we hang on to certain traditions and hunt for new ideas. Well, to help with the hunt, we have the man. I call him the man with the golden palate. He is David Rosengarten. His new book is called It's All American Food, The Food We Really Eat, The Dishes We Will Always Love. David, it is good to see you again.
My gosh, what a pleasure to be here. Great to see you, Lynn.
You know, David, before we get into Thanksgiving,
yes,
I'd like to talk to you about some of the things you say in the American Food Book. Now, in this book, you say that we should forget trying to do authentic dishes from other countries. For some of us, then, there are fighting words.
Well, I mean, it's not that I don't think that authentic is a good goal. Yes, mm-hmm. Please continue, everyone, to make authentic food. However, I am trying to bring up the recognition of the ethnic food that you might call inauthentic. The Italians are the best example. They came here 100 years ago. They couldn't get the ingredients that they used in Italy. So they created a new cuisine here that we call Italian-American. When I was growing up in the 60s, the best chefs in America making Italian food were making that food. Eggplant Parmesan, garlic bread, shrimp marinara, that stuff.
Yeah.
And something happened somewhere in the 70s, somewhere in the 80s, and today the best Italian chefs are not making that. They're making ever higher mountains of radicchio anointed with 100-year-old balsamic vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's good, too. I'm happy with that. But I say, what about paying attention to the old Italian-American food? I'm saying if you give those dishes love and care, spaghetti and meatballs, for example, they're great dishes. And I've done that with 20 ethnic cuisines across the country in this book.
Oh, I can't debate with that thing. Well, okay, let's get into Thanksgiving. I want to know, what's your menu this year?
In this book, there's a large section on regional food. And because I love the creative chefs in the Southwest, having spent some time in New Mexico, I decided to create a Southwestern Thanksgiving. And there's some evidence that there was a very early Thanksgiving party in the Southwest, maybe at the same time as the one in New England.
Interesting.
So this is a Southwestern Thanksgiving, and it includes my most important idea ever, I think, for roasting a turkey.
Which is?
You know how it's hard to get all of the meat in that bird perfectly done at the same time?
Yeah.
This bird, you cook in the oven just until the breast meat is done, and it's really juicy. By the way, the bird is rubbed with a Southwestern spicy rub. Take it out of the oven, present it at the table. There's the big bird.
Right.
And then right at the table, carve off the two halves, the two sides of the breast, which is very easy to do.
Right.
Put it on a board, return the turkey to the oven. And now the thought is that you can make nice slices of the white meat, and I have suggested a sauce and some side dishes that go with the white meat. So now you have a turkey first course with white meat. 20 minutes later, the dark meat is done, and you're ready for course number two, and I've suggested a second sauce to go with the dark meat. Everybody loves having the two-course turkey.
What a surprise it would be.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And by the way, if you're doing a white course and a dark course, you can serve two different wines. People are always saying, what to drink with turkey? You can serve a white American wine with the white and a red American wine with the dark. But with the white, I have a cilantro poblano cream sauce.
Ooh.
That is just heaven. It's white with flecks of green, and it's just beautiful over the turkey
easy
breast.
Easy to do?
Very easy to do. Very easy
okay.
to do.
Okay.
Also easy to do is the sauce that goes with the dark meat turkey, and this is a smoky chipotle mushroom gravy. And it's just studded with chilies and with slices of mushroom, and it's wonderful over the turkey. Now, stuffing time. Stay with me on this, Lynn. This one is really wacky.
Okay.
I came up with a stuffing that basically, you know those crispy taco shells that you buy at the supermarket?
Yeah.
So, and you know, a lot of us who are into like real Mexican food, well, the crispy taco shell, you know, we're sort of like.
Never shall it darken my door.
Yes, but it doesn't have snob appeal. Anyway, I took them and I broke them up and I mixed them with egg and sausage, and it adds this wonderful, rich corn flavor to the stuffing.
Oh, this sounds great.
It's really fantastic.
Okay.
And then I've got some individual jalapeno cornbread loaves to put on the side, and I've also got not just plain old cranberry out of the can, but a cranberry citrus relish with pomegranate seeds and tequila.
That's great.
Oh, the whole party is just terrific.
All right, this is a book about American food, and there's one thing I think a lot of people always have on the Thanksgiving table. It's the green bean casserole with the dirty onions and the whole thing.
Yeah.
No, no, but you know, people love to laugh at it, but it's like Jell-O salad. If it's my tradition, darn it, I eat it and I like it. But do you have a take on that particular dish?
I do. You know, the book, it also has a section we call classic, the foods that people make everywhere across America in their homes. So, of course, in 1955, I believe it was, the Campbell Soup Company, on the back of the cream of mushroom soup, they printed this recipe for the green bean casserole with the crispy onions on it, with cream of mushroom soup, and it was their most popular recipe ever, and it has become a classic. And things don't become classics if they're not good, if they don't have something good about them. So I included it in the book, but I did, it says in the title, judiciously updated. I changed it slightly. There are fresh mushrooms put in, as well as the cream of mushroom soup. It's in there.
Yeah.
But the biggest leap is I ask you to fry your own shallots, and they are delicious in there. I really love this dish. And by the way, if you look at the recipe, you'll see that there's soy sauce in it. And you may say, okay, Rosengarten's really going the fusion route here.
Right,
he's putting
right.
No, soy sauce was part of the original 1955 recipe.
It was?
Yes.
Okay. I love this kind of archaeological work that you do. Dessert.
Yes. Well, I'm going to give you two ideas that I have in the book. By the way, I don't have a pumpkin pie in the book simply because I couldn't really get to one that I truly, truly loved. I'm not, there's something wrong with me. I didn't get the pumpkin pie gene. A couple of desserts that look to me to be Thanksgiving worthy are from the South, and this is in the regional part of the book, a wonderful old recipe that my Southern friend calls nanner pudding, which is just banana pudding. And it's you line a casserole with vanilla wafers that you buy at the store and pieces of banana, and then you pour over it Jell-O vanilla custard. Now, I know this is sounding weird to you, but I am telling you, I so love this recipe. It's so easy to do, and it's so homespun. It's like, did you ever travel to those great cafeterias that they have in Texas and across the South? And it's just real food. It's really good. Also, though, at a slightly higher level, though I'm not saying better, but at a slightly higher gastro level, there is a pecan pie that, without a doubt, is the greatest pecan pie I've ever tasted. It is pecans, of course, but also walnuts, bourbon flavored, and it's got chocolate in it as well. And the chocolate just melts all over the nuts. And it sounds like you're adding all those things. It might be heavier than a pecan pie.
Right.
It's just the opposite, because the pecans are the heaviest of all. So whatever you're adding and taking out pecans, it's making it lighter. It's like a light, fluffy, moussey, chocolatey, bourbon-soaked pecan pie. It's so good.
David, thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Lynn.
David Rosengarten is creator of the newsletter, The Rosengarten Report. His latest book is It's All American Food. Now you can get all of those recipes for his Thanksgiving menu on the website, splendidtable.org. John Hodgman writes for Men's Journal magazine. He writes about food and drink. Now, I'm not talking reviews and recipes. For John, food is about his life, about letting it lead him down those paths seldom traveled. It's about questioning the very foundations of civilization as we know it. Well, John's latest piece is called You're Not a Man Until You Can Carve. John Hodgman, welcome back to the Splendid Table.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, now, the last time we spoke, you were struggling with the zen of dieting. Now I understand it's carving. So what's the story?
Well, a couple of Christmases ago, I received an enormous knife in the mail from my father-in-law, which is not always a promising sign. This is during a time when you could send enormous knives through the mail, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was part of this very elaborate carving set that he had sent me, with these beautiful handles made of sandbar staghorn from India and this royal purple carrying case. And I realized that there was more to this than just a knife. These were something I had to live up to, a kind of work of art, and I like to think of them as weapons forged for the art of defending civilization.
So, I mean, was he telling you were going to be carving the Thanksgiving bird or the holiday, whatever?
well, that I should be able to. The fact is, all civilized carnivores should know how to do this. I mean, if we only eat burgers, then we lose our connection with what we're actually eating. And carving is really about communing to a degree with the food that you're about to eat. You know, it probably derived from a very basic function, divvying up the kill in some proto-history, but like most carnivorous arts, it took on an air of theater and ritual, a way of paying homage to the life that we've taken in order to sustain ourselves and to reconcile fairly primitive hungers with this elevated idea of civility.
I've never thought of carving that way before.
Well, it's like, I mean, you're basically bringing butchery into the dining room with dress-up clothes. And that's why, I mean, that's why it's so intimidating. It's not only that you have to keep your blazer clean, you have to hold up a tradition that is handed down to you for hundreds and hundreds of years, this art of carving.
Well, what happened next?
Well, I figured, you know, I was too afraid to call my father-in-law and ask him how to carve. So I instead made an overseas call to Simpsons on the Strand, that great old former chess club where they've been practicing the theater of carving every night for almost 175 years.
That's now, in London, I don't know, right?
Yeah, it's in London. I should have. Yeah. Robin Easton, the general manager there, went on and on about how you should never let anyone else even come close to touching your knife, you know. But it's true because it is the knife that's going to do most of the work. Let me give you an example. You know, if this is theater, the first act, we're going to deal with the dark meat.
No, we're talking turkey here, right?
Yeah, we're going to talk. Well, it's November after all. And it's all we ever talk about in November is turkey, right?
Okay.
So what you're going to do is start with the bird in front of you with the legs pointing off to the right. And the first act is the darkest and the bloodiest. It's the thigh and the leg, the dark meat. You firmly grasp your fork and plunge it into the breast of the turkey so that it really cannot move around. And then you take the knife and just let it fall through the skin surrounding the thigh until you get just down to the joint that connects the thigh to the bird itself. Then you're going to twist outward, pushing against the thigh with the flat of the blade until the joint pops out or is exposed enough such you can take the point of the blade, stick it in there, twist, and it'll kind of, in a disgusting sucking sound, come away from the bird. But, you know, that's when you can pass on to the more precise work of the breast. And your guests, having gone through watching this happen, will now enjoy the cathartic, gracious artistry of slicing the breast, which is really kind of an approach towards perfection. You know, it's a beautiful thing to do if you can do it well. Now, the way to do it well is, first of all, have an incredibly sharp knife. Now, what you do is make an undercut with your blade parallel to the table and as close to the wing as possible. Make a horizontal cut along the breast of the bird all the way back to the cavity, from the front to the back. That's where your slices, when you start cutting down, will naturally stop and fall away from the
bird. Ah, okay.
The next thing you want to do is you always want to start now with your blade absolutely perpendicular to the table. You want to be cutting straight down, not at an angle. You want to start out and work your way in. Let the knife just touch the skin, probably in the top third of the blade. Move the knife gently forward until you feel it just begin to bite into the meat. And then keep going and then slowly bring it back. What you don't want to do is saw. What you want to do is continue to move the blade gently such that it basically falls through the meat. Once you get down to the bottom of the slice, it'll fall away from the undercut. You can use the fork to lift the slice off of the bird and then arrange it on the plate. And people will sigh and applaud. And it's just a wonderful thing to see. And ultimately, even though it might have started as a sort of alpha male control of portions after the hunt, carving is really about humility. Because if you're not paying close attention to what's happening, you're not going to serve your guests properly. And that, at the end of the day, is what you're doing. You're serving it up.
John, thank you. And happy Thanksgiving.
My pleasure.
John Hodgman is contributing editor to Men's Journal magazine. His article on carving appeared in the November 2003 issue. Food aside, this time of year is really about family, however you define that. Family comes in every size and kind and in every culture. Indian food writer Raghavan Iyer, who's author of The Turmeric Trail, Recipes and Memories from an Indian Childhood, has a story of his father.
We were a monetarily poor but richly loved bunch. Appa was the only earning member of the extended family, consisting of his wife, mother, brother, sister-in-law, and the kids, 14 members in all. We lived in a 300-square-foot chawl, a single-room unit in a crowded apartment building within the heart of Matunga, Mumbai's Tamilian district. The kitchen was squished in a corner of the room, the few pots and pans and the two kerosene burner stoves stacked neatly against the wall. We shared a communal bathroom across the hall with three other units, making bath times something of a logistical nightmare. Kind-hearted and generous Appa was never frugal in showering his children with love and affection, especially his firstborn, my sister Lully. Once a week, on his day off from working for the Indian Navy, after almost everyone was asleep, his ritual journey began. He quietly stepped over the sea of sleeping bodies, clutching a few coins in his right hand, a tall stainless steel tumbler in his left. He stepped bare-chested, a cotton angostrum draped over his left shoulder, with no shoes or slippers on his calloused feet, down the chipped stairs, onto the quiet street, and around the corner to the dairy vendor's stall. A gargantuan wok filled halfway with simmering milk rested on a massive kerosene stove. No words were spoken as coins exchanged hands. The vendor grabbed two urn-like brass containers and ladled hot milk into one of them. He pitched in some sugar, finely chopped unsalted pistachio nuts, and almonds. With one deft motion, he poured the mixture into the other jug. Soon the motion was repeated between the two vases, back and forth, without a drop of milk spilling on the ground. He poured it into Appa's waiting tumbler to the brim, a halo-like fizz crowning its rim. Appa shuffled back to the room, holding the hot drink with his angostrum, careful not to lose even a single drop. Lully was the only one awake, huddled in a corner on the balcony, poring through her medical books under the light of the moon, aided by an oil lamp. Appa handed the glass to his oldest pride and joy. Lully sipped the beverage, the foam forming a white mustache above her lip, the sweetened milk warming her throat. Appa crawled into a little space next to Amma and smiled in the dark, proud of his daughter who fought the odds and was well on her way to becoming a physician. He caressed Amma's bare wrists, white rings visible in the moonlight against her tanned skin where her gold wedding bangles used to be. Now they rested in the jeweler's window display, pawned to pay for medical school, the family sacrifices offset by encouraging warm, nutty milk that would remain embedded in Lully's memory forever.
Indian food expert Raghavan Iyer is author of The Turmeric Trail, Recipes and Memories from an Indian Childhood. You can get his recipe for steamed milk with pistachios and almonds on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. When did the national celebration of Thanksgiving really begin? And we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target store all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, when did the national celebration of Thanksgiving really begin? Well, it wasn't with the Pilgrims back in the 1600s. The Thanksgiving we know, a national day of thanks taking place every fourth Thursday in November, was made official by Abraham Lincoln in 1863. It was right in the middle of the Civil War. Later presidents kind of fiddled with the date, but the national holiday idea stuck. But don't give much credit to Lincoln or the Pilgrims. One woman campaigned nearly 40 years for Thanksgiving. She was Sarah Josepha Hale, and she had a magazine called Gottie's Ladies' Book. Just imagine W, People, and Better Homes and Gardens all rolled into one. Women's magazines really got Thanksgiving rolling. But I'm not sure how I really feel about this. Now, just listen to this quote from the 1890s. On Thanksgiving morn, knowing your duty, throw dull care to the winds. Let the little ones romp, the cat purr by the fire, and the man of the house smoke his cigar in the parlor. Fat chance.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We have Jan calling from St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Jan, how are you? What's up?
Great. How are you?
Fine.
Good, good. Listen, I saw a sauce being served in the movie Chocolat. Do you remember that movie?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was set outside in a beautiful garden, and it was a luncheon, and they were ladling over this roasted chicken, beautiful dark chocolate sauce. And I was wondering, what could that be?
I know the answer to that one.
Goody.
Yeah. Well, you know, for those of you who don't remember it, the film Chocolat was about a woman that almost had magical powers. Okay. That moves into a French village and opens a chocolate shop and sort of changes the psyche of the village. I have a feeling that it may have been some version, perhaps, of a Mexican mole sauce. Oh. And are you familiar with mole? Have you ever heard of it?
I've heard that name. I've heard the sauce name.
Because what mole is chocolate's just a minor part of it, but it is there. And it's a very, you know, people, we all latch on to that because we just don't associate chocolate with savory dishes. But what essentially mole is, it's a complicated sauce, but you can make it ahead. And what it is pounded nuts. Okay. As I recall, there's garlic as well. There's spices like cinnamon and clove, possibly nutmeg. And then there's several different kinds of chilies that are roasted and then soaked and then pureed. And the idea is that I think you like fry the spices in something like a great tasting lard, or you could use probably other fats as well. And then you cook in the chilies and all these other flavorings, and you let this bubble for a while. And then the final thickening and sort of one of the finishing touches is a small bit of chocolate. And I cannot remember if it's an unsweetened chocolate or it's a typical Mexican chocolate, which would be chocolate that's blended with sugar and almond and cinnamon.
Oh.
And it's very coarse. It's the same chocolate you use to make Mexican hot chocolate. But the chocolate adds depth and a certain, think about the bitterness, you know. The chocolate adds a certain kind of depth to it and a little bit of a snap. And of course, yeah, with the heat of the chilies, it would be glorious.
Mm, that sounds great.
And it's traditionally served over turkey or chicken.
Oh, wonderful, for Thanksgiving.
Well, you know what? It would be a dynamite thing to do for Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's great. Can I have one more question
sure.
for you quickly? In New Orleans, Joe, my husband, was served raw oysters over a bed of savory champagne gelatin cubes.
Ooh.
Now, I have never heard of a gelatin of savory,
and he
said it was just wonderful.
Oh, well, you know what? Savory gelatins go way back, and don't get me started on the historical stuff, because, you know, you're going to be here for a half hour. The short answer is, yeah, there are savory gelatins, and a champagne gelatin, for instance, off the top of my head, by the way, you don't necessarily need champagne, you want white wine.
Okay.
Right. You might simmer the wine with a little bit of broth. This is to get rid of some of the alcohol.
Okay.
And your favorite seasonings, like you could have garlic in there, you could have onion, you know, you could have celery and carrot, you could have certain spices.
Or chop up a fresh herb. Maybe.
Yes, exactly. But the thing is, you want it to be very clear, mm-hmm. and then what you do is you add unflavored gelatin to it. And you let that gel, and then you can cut it into little cubes. Yeah, and it would be fabulous. It's also, it's the kind of thing that's kind of fun to have on the table. You have a hot soup, and then you have an intensely flavored little cube that's wine and maybe chili and spice and whatever, and it's cold, and you drop it right in the middle of the hot broth.
Mm-hmm.
And you let people scoop it up very fast before it completely melts.
Well, it looks like this is what I'm having for Thanksgiving.
Hey, this is great. We may come to your house, Jen.
Great. I'd love to have you.
You take care.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. Think about playing around with that idea of hot and cold, you know? Oh, let's see. Who's up next? We've got Valerie calling from Wilmington, North Carolina. Hey, Valerie, how are you?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm good. What's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, my question concerns tomatoes, not just in Spanish recipes, although as a Spanish professor, I go to Spain several times a year, and
uh-huh.
I use a lot of Spanish cookbooks and recipes from friends that I get over there. So I guess my question would most concern that, but really it boils down to when a recipe calls for the use of tomatoes, which are seeded,
mm-hmm.
how faithful do we need to be to that instruction? And if we do, is there a good way of getting the seeds out of the tomatoes without sitting there for eons trying to do so? I mean, I've been stopped dead in my tracks and thought, you know, I'm in a hurry. I'd like to finish this recipe sometime in the near future.
Yeah, right. Sometime in the next 8 hours.
Do I just ignore it, or should I really pay attention to that instruction? Or what?
Well, there's two reasons why you'll find things that'll be called for being peeled and seeded. And one reason is you want only the pulp of the tomato and not the extra juice that you get from the seeds, etc. And a lot of people believe that the peel and the seeds can give a bitter flavor to a sauce.
Okay.
Now, I've occasionally found that to be so, but it's very rare. If the tomato, the fresh tomato, tastes absolutely fabulous when you bite into a piece of it, seeds and peel and all, it's probably going to taste pretty fabulous when you cook with it. But if the recipe is about not having excess moisture, then you want to remove the seeds. Now,
okay.
Here's two quick ways to do this, okay? To peel it, one of the fast ways to do it, I don't like putting anything in water like a tomato because I really believe that it tends to not concentrate the flavor but kind of dilute it, because
right.
usually they tell you to dip it in hot water.
Really quick and get
right.
it out fast. Yeah.
You put the tomato on a long fork, you put it over your burner,
okay.
and you just sear it real quick on all sides, and you can let it cool for a minute. The skin will just slip right off.
Okay.
To seed the tomato, cut it in half and squeeze. And out will come most of the seeds. You know, if there's a few in there, it is not the end of the world.
Okay.
All right. Now, this time of year, since tomatoes are pretty crummy, in the cool months, and a recipe, if you want to seed with a canned tomato, always buy whole canned tomatoes, by the way. You'll get the best flavor. When you start buying puree and crushed, you could be getting cheap tomato paste, which gives it a metallic flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So you buy the whole canned tomatoes, you lift one out, you stick your finger in it, you squeeze, and out comes those seeds.
Oh. That's great. That's
so,
really terrific.
So, you know, I always respect an author. If an author of a recipe says peel and seed, then they have a reason. Personally, I use when I'm making up my own recipes, doing my own food, sometimes I do, most of the times I don't.
Okay. Well, now that I know the correct procedure, I won't be so willing to turn the page and find another recipe.
Right. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, Valerie. I can remember the recipe that said I should peel each chickpea.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. I know. That's when I set my limits. There are some things we do not do.
Right. Thank you very much.
You take care.
Okay.
Goodbye. Bye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up next. It's Geneva calling from Seattle. Geneva, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm just starting as a personal chef.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So this great French cookbook I have said, always cook out the alcohol from your wine when you make a marinade, otherwise it will be horrible and horrible things will happen.
Mm.
And I have never really heard that before.
Oh, my. What book was it? Do you remember?
The French Laundry Cookbook.
Well, that's Thomas Keller. And he is he's the chef there, and he is certainly one of the most brilliant minds around today. But frankly, I've never heard that in a marinade you would cook off the alcohol before you marinate in the marinade. What you're left with then is an essence of flavor, which I think is great. I mean, the idea is not a bad one at all. What you get when you marinate in, you know, just the wine or whatever without cooking off. And by the way, you never cook off all the alcohol, by the way.
You need it.
Well, no, it's not just that you need it. It's just that if you're ever cooking for people who have any kind of substance problem, you know, for instance, they're alcoholics and they can't have alcohol, know that you can't cook with it, because no matter how much you cook a dish, you will never get rid of all the alcohol. There will always be a trace. And, you know, if someone has a chemical problem in their system, it could react with that. But that's an aside. The alcohol does have some factor in it, because what alcohol does is there is, I'm going to back up, a little food science for you, okay?
Okay.
One of the things is that there different flavors are soluble in different substances. In so many words, different flavors are released in different substances. So water-based things like broth and that kind of thing will release one family of flavors. Fats will release another family of flavors. But alcohol releases both family of flavors. And other flavors that aren't soluble in those other two things. So it's one of the reasons why people like to use alcohol in a marinade. They like to use alcohol in a sauce. Even if eventually it's cooked away, those flavors have been released. Now, I would not argue with Thomas Keller. No, only because Thomas Keller truly is a gifted mind. But I think what would be fun for you to try is try his approach and try the uncooked alcohol approach in the same thing, like take two chicken breasts or whatever you want to marinate. It could be really simple. And then cook them side by side and see what you think.
Okay.
I mean, that's the fun of the cooking. The other thing is, if you're going to be doing this for a living, get your hands on some good kitchen science books. Like Shirley Currier did a book called Cookwise. It's a dynamite book. It's a great thing to have handy.
Hmm.
You're going to have a blast.
Yeah, I hope so.
Take care, Geneva.
Okay, thanks.
Bye. Goodbye. Call us, 800-537-5252. Oh, she's starting out on a personal chef. What a great gig. She's going to have a blast. You know, when scholarly types have nothing better to do with their time, they love to debate the firsts. Like, you know, when did somebody eat that first raw oyster? Well, in imbibing circles, a lot of people believe mead was the first fermented beverage. Well, mead is still around big time, especially in that hotbed of ancient custom, Colorado. Yes, mead is becoming the Rocky Mountain drink, and Coors is getting very nervous. We have a mead maker on the phone, David Myers of Redstone Meadery in Boulder. Hey, David, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
David, I don't want to be disrespectful, but why not wine? I mean, why mead?
Well, mead is the world's first beverage. Actually, in this month's Wine Enthusiast, they actually reference mead as the first beverage. And if you're going to make a fermented beverage, you might as well start at the beginning.
So you're working your way toward wine.
You know, I figure for the next 2,000 to 3,000 years, I'll work on mead and, you know, see if we can progress over to wine eventually.
Okay, but, you know, I think you better define what mead actually is.
Well, mead is honey wine, and honey wine is mead. They're actually synonymous terms. And it literally is wine fermented from honey. And it's actually, you know, all beers and all grape wines ultimately stem from mead.
Ah, and it's that idea that the sugar in the honey would ferment with certain yeasts.
Exactly, and that's why it was the first fermented beverage, because nothing, it wasn't invented, it was discovered. Because you would have, you know, wandering tribes who, you know, they would have water, and they would try to sweeten their water, and honey has always been known as the original sweetener.
Right.
And yeast is naturally occurring in the air around us. So because you have that yeast and you have the honey water mixing, they would wind up with spontaneous natural fermentation. And over the course of time, as they're traveling and hunting and so forth, their honey water would become slightly alcoholic honey water because mm-hmm. it had the sugars in it. You know, it made their bellies swell. So for them, that equated to nutrition.
Right.
Of course, it made them feel good.
That would have to be a given with all that alcohol. But what does mead actually taste like?
Well, mead, you know, this is one of the big things that we're out there working on. I mean, mead can taste like anything. You know, if you thought of grape wine as a category, mm-hmm. it would be a huge category. And mead is no different. You can make it dry or sweet. It can be sparkling or it can be still. It can be honey only. You know, different grapes make different grape wine. Different honeys make different honey wine.
Uh-huh.
You can add spices. You can add other fruits. You can age it in oak. You know, you need to remember that grape wine really comes from, as honey resources became expensive,
right.
they needed cheaper fermentables. They started blending some grapes with their honey.
Well, it makes sense because the grapes would be very sweet when they were ripe.
Exactly. Right. And that's the same with beer. You know, they started adding grain with their honey, and slowly but surely they degenerate out to grape wine and to ale.
Uh-huh. Well, this has been an education. We may be bumping the grape off of the dinner table. Hey, David, thank you.
I very much appreciate the time. And, you know, as I say for everybody, please ask for mead.
We will do this. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Goodbye. David Myers is owner of Redstone Meadery in Colorado. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Now, Oscar Wilde had an observation that might be just right for Thanksgiving. He said, after a good dinner, one can forgive anybody, even one's relations. Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It has some of my ideas of what you could be eating midweek. You register for it on the site. It's easy, and best of all, it is free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great Thanksgiving and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.